national concerns over race and criminal justice, all at the center of a new HBO film debuting tonight, one that tells the story of a Jacksonville kid's murder. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a nice weekend out there. The show's always live at 9, and now subscribe to the daily podcast as well on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we will take your calls. As the anniversary of the death of Jacksonville teen Jordan Davis is marked tonight, in the new HBO film, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets. What are your questions? Get on the line now. 549-2937. Also this morning, First Coast author Dr. Bert Herring on how to correct your appetite, as he calls it, to keep the pounds off this holiday season. Then later, artist Julian de Casabianca and Cole Pepper with the Jaguars' big win, and all of the rest of the weekend sports, all of that ahead. But first this hour, today, November 23rd, marks the third anniversary of the shooting of Jacksonville teen Jordan Davis. Davis was killed on Black Friday 2012 after a gas station altercation he had with Michael Dunn over some loud music. Davis was African American and 17 years old. Dunn, who is white, is currently serving a life sentence in the killing. However, he controversially was tried twice in Jacksonville for that murder, with a jury deadlocking on a first-degree murder charge the first time around. HBO is marking the Davis anniversary tonight as the cable channel debuts a favorite from the Sundance Film Festival, the new documentary 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets. The film was shot right here in town, and it tells the story of Davis's death and Michael Dunn's two very high-profile murder trials. Dr. Jeffrey N. Wilder, UNF race expert and associate professor of sociology, joins us now with more about the movie and the continued national concerns around race and justice. Dr. Wilder, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Lots of calls already as we discuss the anniversary of Jordan Davis's death and the HBO debut tonight of the new documentary film, 3.5 minutes, 10 Bullets. Get on the line now with your thoughts and questions. 549-2937 to join us. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show, and in a few minutes, weigh in, if you could, on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And so it was 3 years ago today, it was Black Friday, Dr. Wilder, in 2012, when Davis and a few of his friends went out for the evening, pulled into a gas station, and got into an altercation with Michael Dunn, who was in town for the weekend only for a wedding. From there, things turned violent.
Everything changed, I think. Both parties, you know, Jordan Davis and his friends were doing some shopping, and Mr. Dunn and his, partner at the time were in town for a wedding. And it's sort of this classic example of what happens when, tensions collide. And of course, we see what happens, the negative consequences of racial microaggressions.
Is that how you would define the interaction between Michael Dunn and Jordan Davis?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people wanted to make the case or did not want to make the case, racialized, but it clearly was. And in the film, you definitely see that throughout the documentary, that it was initially an altercation about loud music. But then that loud music, of course, became contextualized within the context of race. Hearing Mr. Dunn talk about those kids and that kind of quote unquote thug music is clearly racialized and racially motivated. And while he admits to doing what he did in the basis of fear, it's really fear connected to young African-American males.
The film gets into these issues at length. As I mentioned, it debuts tonight on HBO. The trailer is available for viewing. We have the audio from the trailer. Let's listen.
Fire rescue. We had shots fired in the parking lot.
I said, what happened to Jordan?
I was scared for my life, mm-hmm. And you guys are seeing this as murder.
Was there music playing in the car?
Yes.
What type of music was playing?
Rap.
Did the defendant say anything about the music?
I hate that thug music.
Thug is the new N-word.
And look, and I'm looking at a barrel. I said, you're not gonna kill me, you son of a...
There's no weapons in that car.
Was he all right to kill my son?
And that's the trailer for the new HBO film, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It will debut tonight on the premium cable channel. And Dr. Wilder, we heard lots of people talking in that trailer. One of the voices I remember is that of Michael Dunn. As he took the stand in his own defense, he testified that he felt threatened by Jordan Davis and his friends, and that he believed that they had a gun and were going to shoot him, which is why he explained he shot first.
Absolutely. And throughout the course of the documentary, we had the fortune of being able to screen the film about a month ago on our campus. And throughout the course of the film, Mr. Dunn does not think that his actions were wrong. I mean, the film ends and you still see, this very real in his mind fear, fearful of his life.
He was afraid, he said, and that is why he fired on the group of teens. 10 bullets, as the film is titled. The reason this trial became so well-known and notorious, in fact, around the country, is that in his first trial, the jury deadlocked. Let's talk about that.
Right. So in the first trial, the jury found Mr. Dunn guilty of attempted murder of the other three friends in the car that evening, but were deadlocked on the murder, the premeditation piece, I believe, the first-degree murder of Jordan. And so it was, to a lot of people, justice was not served. And so I think in the second trial, having Mr. Dunn being convicted of murder was in the minds of very many getting justice.
The jurors that held out and did not want to convict Dunn on a first-degree murder charge believed that he was acting, in his mind, in self-defense.
Yes, and I think that is exactly why it was so controversial, because, you know, you've got people very much divided and saying, how in the world could he have thought he was defending his life? But again, you know, listening to his testimony and the way in which he recounted the day's events, it's clear in his mind, at least, that's what he was doing.
And how do you see this trial and in the aftermath, Jordan's parents, Ron Davis and Lucia McBath, have become activists and have now formed the Jordan Davis Foundation. How do you see this story and the resulting film telling a larger story about how in this country we remain divided when it comes to these issues of race and how race interacts with the criminal justice system?
So this particular case, the death of Jordan Davis happened on the heels of the death of Trayvon Martin earlier in 2012. And then again, you know, it's just the timing. Everything has shifted in our society in that short period of time. These past 3 years, our racial climate in our society has moved from one of just being tense to really being broken. We're really at an impasse because we continue to see these types of cases, individuals harming others, because of, quote-unquote fear or what have you. And then you also see, of course, things playing themselves out in the criminal justice system. And we've seen that with many cases over the past few years. And even yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the death of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old African-American boy who was shot by the police after playing, because they thought he had a gun. It was actually a toy gun. So we're just at a time where these kinds of cases continue to permeate our nation's consciousness, and we cannot get away from it. And so now we're really at a point where we need to move forward. And I think that Jordan's family, his parents, they've really done a great job in being very vocal about moving things forward and not allowing Jordan's death to be in vain, and to really allowing his legacy to move forward.
And let's go to your calls and comments right now. As HBO Tonight debuts the new film, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, the documentary shot here in Jacksonville tells the story of the death of Jordan Davis, killed 3 years ago today in the city. 549-2937 to join us. Hector in San Jose. Hi, Hector. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. First of all, I'd like to say, I have a couple of things I want to say. I noticed when a black or Hispanic male is murdered in Duval County, they always say he was killed. Well, killing is when you kill an animal. We are not animals, we are human beings, and I wish the media would report that as a murder. You're talking about the subject's man, you keep saying this man was killed, he was murdered in cold blood. I don't think it's right, particularly in this particular county, how they go about jury selection in such a biased way. I have been down there myself what has happened, the most intelligent people that are sitting there are never selected for the jury. They always select someone of a lower economic status who doesn't really want to be there to be on these type juries. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to get a go-along-to-get-along type individual that sits on these juries. This is a very biased county when it comes to dealing with minorities. But I wish the media would report that this man was murdered. He was not killed. You kill a deer or you kill some other type animal for food. This man, this young man, he was not even a man, he's a young man, was murdered. It's very disturbing to me that the media does not value the lives of brown and black peoples in this county. They don't. I will take my answer off the phone. Thank you.
Thank you, Hector. I can't speak for all media outlets in this city or in this country, but as I'm looking back through my script tonight, I use the term murder 3 times, the term killing 3 times, and also that he was shot, fatally shot a couple of times. And that's simply so that I can write a compelling script. But I appreciate your perspective on this. At the same time, he also had some comments about jury selection and just an overall sense of frustration with the system. Dr. Wilder.
I think, you know, Hector's comments are, you know, quite valid. The issue of racial bias in jury selection is something that our nation is currently taking up right now. So it's not just something that is an issue in Duval County. We're looking at this at the national level, and I hope that there will be some changes because, you know, in a number of cases, there's always there's lots of concern about the jury and whether or not they're actually, you know, that people actually have a fair shake. I do want to speak to the caller's comments about Jordan Davis being a human being. One thing this documentary does quite well is really humanizes Jordan Davis and his life, and it doesn't spend a whole lot of time focusing, clearly it's surrounding the nature of his death, but I think the documentary does a fantastic job of really humanizing Jordan Davis and really saying that he was a young man who lost his life way too soon and was very well loved by a lot of people.
549-2937. Let's go now to Gail in St. Augustine. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I definitely agree that the death of Jordan Davis had a racial component, and I am actually very glad there was the retrial and the conviction here. However, I think there is a larger issue, and that is the ready availability of a gun in this situation. And I look to the tragic trial that will be coming up next January of Mr. Reeves in the movie theater who shot and killed the father who had been texting his daughter's babysitter during the previews. You know, there's no real racial component there, but again, it was the fact that that there was this ready availability of a gun in a very minor altercation, and that resulted in the tragic death. And I think the Florida legislature is so wrong to be moving towards having these open carry bills and having more people armed. I just think it will lead to more tragedy. Thank you, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Gail. And in the wake of Jordan's death, we do need to note that his parents have become activists around the issue of gun violence. His mother, Lucia McBath, has joined the national group Moms Demand Action on Gun Sense. So Jordan's parents, Dr. Wilder, have joined with callers like Gail on taking that side of the issue.
Absolutely. And we all know that we have a huge pressing issue with gun violence in our nation. And of course, when you mix gun violence and, you know, sort of things get out of hand, things escalate. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And you're right. Jordan's parents have both, you know, been quite active against gun violence and also other issues and really have worked with other families who have been impacted by tragedies connected to gun violence.
They've also spoken out against Florida's Stand Your Ground law, which did figure into the Dunn trial. It wasn't the leading issue in the trial, but it was part of Michael Dunn's defense. What would you say to the majority of Floridians who approve of the Stand Your Ground law?
Well, I think it's really interesting because there was a really, really nice piece in yesterday's Times Union about Stand Your Ground, and it is a very quite controversial, policy. And I think a lot of times people think that it is used in more instances than it really is. And again, it's this idea of being able to stand your ground in the face of fear, whether that's real fear or, you know, sort of constructed fear, perceived fear. But I think it's another one of those issues, just like gun violence and other policies, that really need to be addressed. Because this case is about a number of things. Definitely race has a big backdrop in it, but it's about stand your ground. It's about gun violence. It's about you know, all these other issues that, of course, make this, something that we continue to talk about.
Let's go now to Wells in Atlantic Beach this morning. Hello, Wells.
Good morning, Melissa and Dr. Wilder. How are you guys?
Great, thank you.
Morning.
As a matter of fact, I just want to pick up on what Dr. Wilder said a second ago. And there's a front page, as a matter of fact, discussing Stand Your Ground, and it shows all the people who have been convicted and not convicted, and it's pretty telling that it's a different story when you examine what is happening. I'd like to say that Michael Dunn, I've seen the film twice now, and Michael Dunn, as Dr. Wilder said, showed no remorse for what he did. As a matter of fact, near the end of the documentary, he says that, basically paraphrasing what he said, was that, you know, if he hadn't killed Jordan Davis, Jordan Davis would have probably killed someone else. And I think that's the real telling thing about our society. I think the gap between black and whites has widened, and I think it's widened because of right-wing media. I think it's widened because there's no real discussion or education in our schools about one another. And we need to come to grips with the fact that we are one people. And racism goes all the way back to, slavery. And the disconnect between blacks and whites was something that was set up to divide us, so that we would not come together and fight for what we need. And I think the grassroots movement is starting to build in the United States between blacks and whites. And I just want to thank you guys for having this show on today. Thank you.
Thank you. Donna is in Arlington. Go ahead, Donna.
Yes, this is Donna from Arlington, and I'd just like to ask Dr. Wilder's perspective on the differences in the two cases between the defendant for Trayvon Martin versus the defendant for Jordan Davis, why she felt that George Zimmerman, for instance, was acquitted versus the defendant in the Jordan Davis case was convicted.
Okay, so you're asking my personal perspective because, you know, I'm not an attorney, so I can't provide you with a legalized context. But I do think that the facts of the case in Jordan Davis's murder, were probably, I think, maybe perhaps the second go-round for a jury a lot more compelling.
It was a very open and shut case.
Right, right.
In the minds of the jury.
Right. Whereas in the case of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, there was a lot of question connected to their physical altercation and really whether or not Mr. Zimmerman was justified in doing what he did in killing Trayvon Martin. I think that's a big piece of it. So I think that's the difference.
And as we discuss the 3-year anniversary of the death of Jacksonville teen Jordan Davis, the new HBO film, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, debuts tonight on the cable channel, telling the story of Davis's life, his murder, and the trial of Michael Dunn. And we're taking your calls on it right now. 549-2937. Daniel in St. Augustine is with us. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Great, thank you.
My comment is, well, none of us were there, and we don't really know what happened. But if from what I understand, there was a lot of obnoxious music being played loudly, and he was asked that they were asked to turn the music down. Why didn't he just turn it down, and that would have ended the whole thing?
Daniel, yeah, thanks for the call. And that question came up during the first trial and the second trial. That question was posed. Your answer, Dr. Wilder.
Well, the one question that we never ask is why didn't Mr. Dunn just walk away? You know, obnoxious music is all relative. You know, Mr. Dunn didn't like the music. Okay, that's fine. That's not a reason to pull out his gun and shoot 10 bullets. And actually, there were lots of witnesses, and I think that's one of the bigger differences between this case and the Trayvon Martin case, is that Ronda Rousey is actually a fighter.
who lost her fight.
Right. So Ronda, I can't remember her last name, who was Michael Dunn's fiance, was there. There are people in the gas station that were there. The three young men who were in the car with Jordan, they were there. There are lots of witnesses there. And to shoot someone because you don't like their music, or you're asking someone to turn the music down and they say no, you know, I think it's, again, we get caught up in blaming the victim. Well, if he had just turned his music down, well, what if Mr. Dunn, who was a 45-year-old grown man who knew better than a 17-year-old, he could have very easily de-escalated that situation and just walked away to no consequence, but he didn't. And so I think if we're going to ask that question of Jordan Davis, we need to make sure that we're asking that same question of Mr. Dunn.
The film screened on the UNF campus recently. How did that go over?
It was fantastic. We screened the film on October 27th of last month. We had close to 600 folks in attendance. We also, in addition to screening the film, we did a panel afterwards, and Mark O'Mara, who was the who was a defense attorney and also was George Zimmerman's defense attorney, was on the panel, in addition to Ron Davis, Jordan's father. We also had Director Michelle Cook from JSO and also Shavar Owen, who is a community activist, on the panel, and it was fantastic. It was a great event. It was very, very riveting, and it was a really great thing for our students and in UNF community to be able to see.
And everyone who subscribes to HBO, of course, can watch the film this evening as it debuts. It's my understanding there might even be a few snippets from this talk show in the production. I'll be tuning in overall, though, just to see the film itself. Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder of UNF, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, much more still ahead later. Cole Pepper on the Jaguars' big win Thursday. Also, a conversation with artist Julian de Casabianca on his exciting new Outings project here in Jacksonville, taking great art and putting it out in public. But up next, First Coast author Dr. Burt Herring on how to control, or as Herring would say, correct your appetite during the holidays. That's in a moment.
Join WJCT December 15th at the WJCT Studios as we celebrate the final season of Downton Abbey with a cocktail reception and a sneak preview of Season 6. Reception begins at 6:30 with the preview event to begin at 7:30. Tickets are $30 and include a chance to win a Downton weekend at Sea Island. Costumes are optional but encouraged. More info at wjct.org/events or 358-6327.
Nearly 200 countries are coming together next week to address climate change, and this is the woman conducting the orchestra.
Yes, we have most of the technology that we need, we have the capital, we're moving on the policy. We just need to focus and understand the urgency of this.
A conversation with UN Climate Chief Christiana Figueres later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Looking for the perfect gift? Want to support WJCT? Shop the WJCT Holiday Auction. Hundreds of items, including Jacksonville Symphony tickets, Alhambra dinner tickets, weekend getaways, and much more. Log on to auction.wjct.org. Auction ends Monday, November 30th, 9 p.m.
Welcome back. Well, this week we officially begin the season of eating, and at this time of year, the pounds can certainly creep up on us. However, local physician and author Dr. Burt Herring says there's a simple way to maintain your weight. Herring, the author of The Fast Five Diet, provides a set of 15 sustainable tools to build a weight loss and weight maintenance lifestyle in his new book. It's called AC, The Power of Appetite Correction. Dr. Burt Herring, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
And, you know, we have a Harry and David Tower of Treats out there in the newsroom that just got delivered, so I'm going to try to correct my appetite and try not to eat everything right in front of me, which is so difficult for all of us at this time. You talk about appetite correction in this book, and that's in the title. What do you mean by appetite correction?
Appetite correction is a new look at the way that people actually gain weight. I wrote a book 10 years ago called The Fast Five Diet and The Fast Five Lifestyle. It was one of the first books about a daily cycle of intermittent fasting. And over the years, I've been listening to people who've practiced this diet and understood that the way that this really works is because it helps correct appetite. And a lot of people aren't familiar with what that means, but what it means is that you simply want to eat less food. It's not like you're trying to hold back. Your body holds you back. And if you look at the wild animals in the world, you can see appetites working because a lion doesn't keep hunting after it's had its fill. It just hangs out for a while, and then it gets hungry, and then the appetite kicks in, and it goes and chases down another gazelle. But the human appetite center is rather confused. And so these tools are all about helping that natural appetite center work like it's supposed to.
You provide tools that get us back to the way our hunter-gatherer forebears used to live.
That's the idea, without having to shut off the electricity and the television and, and all the screens, yes.
So what are some of the tools that you recommend?
Well, one of the first and the most powerful tool is the one that came from the book 10 years ago, and that is to change the schedule. And the Fast Five schedule, and by the way, the Fast Five book is a free download. Anybody can get that for free. And it's limiting eating to a five-hour window. And you pick when that window is during the day. And you limit your eating to that five-hour window. And when that's done for about 3 weeks, and it does take a little time to kick in, but then the appetite center and the brain seems to get the idea that, oh, we've got some surplus. We can use that instead of piling on more food. And when that's done, the desire to eat falls and you start to lose weight. And we've seen this happen thousands of people over the years doing very well with it.
And so that's an essential building block.
It is.
But there are some other tips in this book.
Yeah, there are some other tips. There are things like portion control. When you're looking at your Thanksgiving meal, if you've got a big plate and it's got a little circle on the inside, you can pretend that that plate is the smaller circle. Load that up with the things that you like the most, and then if you want more, you can always go back and get more. But since our tendency is to clean the plate, it's a good idea to start small and go back for seconds rather than piling it on, because that's going to prompt you to overeat if you feel like you have to clean your plate. And that's been one of our cultural lessons over the years, is you can't clean your plate or else it'll be offensive to the kids who are starving somewhere else in the world.
And that turned out to be a pretty counterproductive message to tell our kids, didn't
right.
it?
It did.
So at this time, people are desperate to keep weight off. It gets so difficult, beginning actually probably today. Well, the first holiday treat actually came in the mail today to our WJCT newsroom, and everybody listening to this knows exactly what's coming down the pike over the next couple of weeks, several weeks. Parties, cookies at the office. There will be innumerable opportunities to eat badly between now and January 2nd. What are some other tips and strategies you can share with us to help us navigate this?
The overall strategy behind any diet should be that it shouldn't be a temporary thing. It should be a lifestyle. And if your lifestyle has you either getting to or maintaining an appropriate weight, then you don't have to worry about a little transgression here and there at Thanksgiving or Christmas time during the holidays. Whatever the time is, if you get a little bit heavy at that time, then if you're good the rest of the year, then overall your weight's going to stay the same, and you can enjoy those indulgences. You can enjoy the social activity, which is a very important part of life and one that I really advocate that people maintain as a crucial part of the diet itself. That's part of our healthy diet is the social interaction. So we don't want to put those aside. And so looking at changes that you can keep for a lifestyle is the only kind of changes that I would endorse. And if you've got the lifestyle, then it'll self-correct over time and the holidays won't be any big deal.
Let's hope so. In the meantime, this is a great new book from a local author, AC, The Power of Appetite Correction, from Dr. Burt Herring, out now. Thanks so much for being with us, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Melissa. Happy holidays.
You too. Still coming up, sports with Cole, as the Jaguars are on a roll. Plus, we'll tell you about Jacksonville's Outings Project, putting the world's greatest works of art out in public. That's next.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with the 13th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union locations and Two Men in a Truck at 8849 Arlington Expressway. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area. Train a
ride. Record producer Sam Phillips discovered Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Howlin' Wolf, and Roy Orbison, and recorded them all for his label Sun Records. On the next Fresh Air, we listen to some great music and talk with Peter Guralnick, author of Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to present Michael Feldman's What Do You Know? Live. That's right, I'm bringing my show to Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy a bit of a break from the Wisconsin winter. So, do your holiday shopping early or surprise your Valentine next February. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Welcome back. Well, last year, French artist and filmmaker Julian de Casabianca conspired to release some of the world's greatest art. Typically, it's locked away inside museums, but he wanted to put it into urban settings. His global project called Outings is now in more than 70 locations around the world, including Jacksonville. Now, this is a multi-step experience. First, he isolates figures from these historic works of art, then he prints them out large scale and installs them in public places, and then finally photographs the new composition. The artist is at work right here in Jacksonville this week. We are on the list of Outings cities. Artist Julian de Casabianca now in studio along with Kummer Museum Director Hope McMath and Tony Allegretti of the city's Cultural Council. Thanks for being with us, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks.
Bonjour.
Bonjour to you, and good to meet you in person. I've heard so much about this project. How did the idea for this come to you?
Yes, the idea, I mean, in a museum at Le Louvre. I saw a beautiful girl in a painting, and she was lost and buried. And I had just this pulsion, like charming prince pulsion, to take her and to give her a new life, a new freedom. And I did it just as a joke.
As a joke?
Yeah.
What was the idea of the joke?
Just to paste outside this girl. And just I discovered the power of the act. It was just to play. And I saw how people interact with her. And I saw how it was beautiful. So I decided to do it full-time job.
You kept going and the reaction was pretty extraordinary, wasn't it? People really loved the idea.
Yes. And all different people. It's interesting when I I'm in the street and when I'm to paste, and it's, you have the youngs love it, the old people love it, all different style love it. So it's really interesting to see how the art in museum, it's something for everybody.
Right, because if people can't get inside the museum, you want to make these beautiful works of art available to the whole world. That's the basic idea, right?
The basic, yes, yes, and the basic idea, just to give a new life to just the character inside the painting. It's not all the painting, it's just one person. And we take the person and we give this new life. And in this new life, you have contact with other people in life, passerby, and a connection with her. And it's really beautiful what's happened.
Hoke McMath, the Kummer Museum, is fully on board with this outings project. Jacksonville is an outing city, so that means as people are going about their business, they might see a public art installation that's part of Julian's work.
They will. They're likely to, especially after the last couple of days. So in the last 2 days, we've put up 30 outings around the city. Again, really focusing on parts of the city and the urban landscape where beauty is needed. So we are very intentional about making sure we're picking sites where people will see it from the street, from the sidewalks, where beauty is pushed into the corners that otherwise would simply look like decay.
What are some examples of what people are going to see that Julian's been doing over the last couple of days?
So we have Native Americans from a 19th century American landscape sitting on a sidewalk in San Marco. We have dragons from the Meissen porcelain dishes on walls in downtown. We have Dutch portraits hanging on walls next to a parking lot. We've got women in Japanese kimonos gracing the streets of Springfield. So it's a really beautifully diverse series of images.
But it's not only my work, because everybody can do it. In the world currently, you have 200 persons on all continents. A few days ago, it was one man who did it in Islamabad, Pakistan, from the museum. So here, we did a workshop with the museum. So it's in abeyance we did it. Me, I pasted only 3 or 4. And so all other and are made by
the community.
The community took part. And Tony Allegretti, head of our cultural council, this is taking public art to a new phase in Jacksonville.
Yeah, absolutely. Street art really predates museums. And so it's a great echo effect. And it's so brilliant that people in all different neighborhoods and different walks of life get to see characters from our local museum. I think that's one of the most brilliant things about this, because it sparks an interest. It inspires people, and I think it'll mean more interest in the museum too.
That's right. And the Kummer, Hope, when people visit the Kummer Museum, they can also see some of Julian's photographs in another exhibit.
Yeah, so we have an exhibition up of Julian's photography, which is really extraordinary, because with that, you're not only do you have an understanding of the participatory process that happens, but then you see that, as he calls it, character within this new context, and the photographs themselves are truly extraordinary. And so those just opened on display about a week ago and will be up for several months as inspiration for all of us here in Jacksonville.
And so after spending some time in Jacksonville, where are you off to next?
In New York and Moscow, and a few days ago I was in Tokyo, Hanoi, and just a day before Hong Kong. So
you really are global.
Totally.
Yeah. It's exciting to have you and your concept come to Jacksonville. How was Jacksonville selected to be part of this?
I understand nothing at your question.
How? So Jacksonville, she was asking how Jacksonville was selected. So Jacksonville sort of selected itself a bit.
Okay.
We became very inspired by Julian's work, and a small team of people, Dolph James and Doug Eng and some other folks from the Cork Arts District, stepped up to start doing outings in the city. And then through a connection with Julian, we very quickly invited Julian to come to Jacksonville, and he did, thank goodness.
Excellent. And Tony, you talk about this a lot in terms of the economic impact of art and culture. This is one good example of how public art can drive innovation, foot traffic to downtown neighborhoods and a whole lot more.
Yeah, so I think the net effect is the beauty that we all get to enjoy when we see it. But then how many people, how many families got involved? You know, my mom, three generations of Allegretti's put one up, you know, and this is real interesting. We don't get to do a lot of art projects together. So that's amazing. This city is really teed up for this kind of project and others. I mean, there's so much happening in our community in arts and culture. Hope's done a great job of really putting a spotlight on this.
And I think this city has come a long way in a short time. Just a little while ago, we were talking about an artist having to be arrested for some unauthorized public art.
That's right.
Now we're in a new, I think, sense of understanding in Jacksonville about public art and street art. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say. I think it's been an amazing shift. And actually, that particular artist has been part of our outing street team, Chip Southworth. Shout out to him. But yeah, this idea of art being where we live, where we work, where we play. And though this is just one version of it, there are many ways to experience public art. And we're hoping this raises the conversation to a new level.
Julian, I think you've accomplished your goal, more than accomplished your goal, right here in Jacksonville. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
It's the Outings Project from artist and filmmaker Julian de Casablanca. We were also joined by the Kummer Museum's Hoke McMath and Tony Allegretti of the city's Cultural Council. Keep your eyes peeled for those new public art projects in multiple neighborhoods around town this week. And we'll be right back with Cole Pepper.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Faking happiness at work can have some real side effects, you know.
Often these kinds of workers get mistreated by customers, and they still have to maintain that smile. There's an uneven exchange.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the costs of grinning and bearing it, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Juanita Evangeline Moore, daughter of slain civil rights activists Harry T. and Harriet V. Moore, dedicated her life to preserving her parents' legacy. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll remember Evangeline Moore. We'll discuss how the real first Thanksgiving took place in Florida 55 years before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. That and more on Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Finally, this hour, the Jaguars are relevant during Thanksgiving week for the first time in 6 years.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
The team now 4-6. Cole Pepper here now with highlights from Thursday's game and more sports. And the Jaguars pulling it out again. How about it?
Yeah, they've suddenly won back-to-back games, their first winning streak since 2013. They've won 3 out of 4, and I don't know if you can call them red hot, but they have been finding ways to win where before they were finding ways to lose. And now, you mentioned Thanksgiving. To me, Melissa, Thanksgiving has always been sort of an important mile marker in the NFL season.
Mm-hmm.
Some coaches will break up the season into quarters or whatnot, or you put by month. But if you are in the conversation for a playoff spot over Thanksgiving dinner, you can't call your season a total loss.
Sure.
So that's what's going to be happening. The Jaguars actually had a chance to be tied for the division lead if the Colts and Texans would both have lost yesterday. They both won.
Right.
So here's how the AFC South looks right now. You've got the Colts and Texans at 5-5. Nobody in the division has a winning record. Jaguars are 4-6, so they're a game out of the division title. They're not going to make a wild card. There's no way. One team from the AFC South is going to make the playoffs this year, and the Jaguars actually have a chance to do that. And if you look at their schedule, next up they host 2-8 San Diego, team that's really struggling this year.
They've got a shot on that
they
one.
Absolutely, got to have a shot. You've got games against the Colts without Andrew Luck, the Titans again. Atlanta is probably the toughest team remaining on their schedule, but it is not a murderer's row by any stretch of the imagination. I think the Jaguars, who right now are playing okay in the big picture, they're playing okay. They're not great. They're okay, but I think they have a chance to make a run here and maybe wind up as one of those teams at 8-8 that could get into the postseason if they win 4 of their last 6, which now seems, 2 weeks ago it would have seemed crazy to suggest the Jaguars would win 4 of 6. But now it's at least reasonable to think it can happen. They can actually make a run this year. And I still don't think they're all that good, but the division is awful, and it gives them a great opportunity to make something happen this year.
Let's hope so. Let's keep our fingers crossed for the Jags. Meanwhile, Florida and Florida State this Saturday.
Yeah, that's, of course, the big rivalry game for both teams, and it's a significant game for both teams in different ways. The Gators coming off an overtime victory over FAU that was a lot more difficult than it probably should have been, while FSU whipped Chattanooga. For Florida, they still harbor hopes of making the national playoff. If they beat Florida State and then beat, say, Alabama in the SEC championship game, that would certainly help their resume, and they might, as SEC champions, then get into the Final Four, the four playoff teams. On the other hand, Florida State needs this win to really solidify themselves for a major bowl. They're not going to be one of the teams playing in the for the run for the national championship, but they can get a major bowl. And Dalvin Cook is also important for the running back, who has a decent but not great shot of the Heisman Trophy. Right now it's wide open. Derrick Henry, the former Yulee High School star in Alabama, is probably the front runner right now for the Heisman Trophy, but it is a wide open field here with just a couple of weeks of games to go in the college football season.
And it's certainly an exciting time for college football fans. Thanksgiving at our house always seems to revolve around football. So
football, feasting, and family, right?
That's right. Yeah. Let's talk soccer for a minute. You're wearing your Armada windbreaker,
yes,
of course, this morning on this chilly day. Mm-hmm. The Armada need a coach.
Yes, and that coaching search continues. I think the team would like to have their man before the players take their winter break next month. And you want to start having a coaching staff that starts looking at the personnel and installing certain things in terms of a system. And so that's one thing to look forward to here in the coming days and weeks, to see the Armada find their new head coach.
Last but not least, as Cole reports, 7 Florida schools are still alive in the state high school playoffs.
7 Florida schools in our area. You've got the regional finals for Mandarin, who plays. Bartram Trail will play Lake City Columbia. And Clay High School also in it after an amazing game from Bilal Ali, who had 496 yards rushing.
Jeez.
A Florida high school playoff record last week in their victory. State semifinals for Raines, Trinity Christian, and University Christian all coming up this week. I think Raines is going to wind up playing for a state title. I saw them beat Bowles on Friday night very convincingly. They've got, a fairly easy game against Alachua Santa Fe. Then they would take on either Coco or Booker T. Washington in Orlando for the championship.
Yeah, they've had such a strong program the last few years.
Yeah, and they always have seemed to stumble in the playoffs against Bowles. This time they got by the Bulldogs, and so I think Raines stands a very good chance of becoming the first public high school team in Jacksonville to win a state title since Raines did it last time.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed for Raines as well, and always good to see you. Have a great Thanksgiving, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa. Same for you.
He's at Cole Pepper on Twitter. Follow him for all the latest sports news around town, and that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchek. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, the attacks in Mali and Paris point to a broadening battlefield in a war being waged by disparate jihadist groups. Globalization, religious extremism, and jihad around the world. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.